18 years ago, this month, 9/11 was the most horrific attack on America in modern history. It changed the lives of everyone in the world. I remember it like it was yesterday. And today we have award-winning journalist and historian Garrett Graff on the show to talk about his new book, The Only Plane in the Sky. It's a detailed account of the morning of 9/11 and those that lived through it and eyewitnessed the events that took place that day. Garrett joins us to talk openly about what he learned through the process of this book and his own story and how it changed America and the world. Hi, I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron. This is Truth Be Told, and we welcome to the show, Garrett Graff. 18 years ago, this month, 9/11. Garrett, how you doing, sir? Well, we are so excited to have you here. I'll tell you, I'm trying to get this unlocked here. We are excited to have you here because not only 18 years ago that this happened, but and many of us that were alive that remembered, you know, the first accounts of, oh, it was a small prop plane that hit the towers. And then it changed all of our lives for, you know, in the world. So thank you for being here. I'm excited to share your story and your journey of putting this book together. So I want to start by saying, when you started putting the book together, you start at the airport with the ticket agents. And so I want to go into a little bit more details on how you put this together. How did you begin your journey of saying, I'm going to put this book together and these are the people who are going to do it? Because I'm sure 18 years later, many people either didn't want to share their stories or, you know, are still grieving from the losses. So can you start with that, how you began the book?
Yeah, so the book, The Only Plane in the Sky, grew out of an article that I wrote for Politico magazine that ran for the 15th anniversary of 9/11 in 2016. And what that particular piece started with was just following President Bush through his day on 9/11. I interviewed 28 people who were around him that day, from the pilot of Air Force One to White House Chief of Staff Andy Card to the press aboard the plane, the security, Karl Rove, Ari Fleischer, a lot of the Bush staffers that day. And when the piece originally published, what really struck me was the reader reaction to it. And sort of two in particular really stood out in my mind. The first was a young mother who had two children, 7 and 9, and she was a veteran. And she wrote that she had printed out the article and set it aside so that someday when her children were old enough to read it, she would be able to sit them down and explain to them why mommy had gone off to war. And then the second was another veteran who was younger. He was an Army veteran, had done 3 tours in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and had been actually only in middle school on 9/11. And he said that he had never really understood how traumatic that day was for the country until he read my article and saw the day through President Bush's eyes. And those two reactions just really stuck with me in how this apocalyptic event, this thing that changed the whole world, that changed our modern life in the United States, that changed our politics, changed our geopolitics, that an increasingly large percentage of the population just had no memory of it. They had no emotional connection to it. A quarter of the population today now was either born after 9/11 or was too young on 9/11 to remember the day. And so my goal for turning that original article into this whole book was to try to recapture what that day was like to actually live. Because I think one of the things that stands out to me as I work on this project is just how much the history that we tell of 9/11 does not fully capture that day. That the story that we tell of 9/11 is so much neater and cleaner than the history of the day that we actually lived, those of us who were old enough to remember it. And you were talking about it just in that intro of, you know, the confusion about when the attacks began, the chaos, the fear, the trauma that unfolded over the course of the day, and just sort of what a mystery so much of that day was like to all of us who lived it, whether you were a school kid that day, whether you were close to one of the attacks, whether you were the president or the vice president of the United States. We just didn't understand when the attacks began. We didn't understand when the attacks were over, and we didn't understand what came next. And so this history of the facts of 9/11 that we tell, the attacks beginning at 8:46 in the morning with the first crash into the first tower,
right,
and then ending 102 minutes later at 10:29 with the collapse of the second tower. That's history just sort of doesn't actually, I think, adequately capture the day as America actually lived it. So this book, the goal is to tell the totality of the American experience on 9/11 through the voices of 480 Americans, morning to night, coast to coast.
Well, I mean, just like you said, reliving it, and because you were old enough, I was old enough, but reliving it sometimes, it going back to the time before 9/11, America seemed untouchable. And mm-hmm. and even to this day, most of us are thinking, when is it going to happen again? When is it going to happen again? Before, we just thought that was never going to happen. So, and I think that's always put us on edge as Americans now. Even though we are still the greatest country in the world, we still have that little edge that we fear. But how did you manage to gather such chilling and emotional stories that, and then transfer them to the page? Because that takes talent to be able to put that on the page to really feel the emotion behind it. How did you manage to get the yeah. information?
So the book is a mix of my own original interviews and then archival oral histories that I found in libraries and archives and collections across the country. So there were a number of institutions that after 9/11 had the good sense to go out and try to capture some of these stories and these memories while they were fresh. The 9/11 Museum in New York, the 9/11 Tribute Center in New York, the Capitol Hill Historian, the Pentagon Historian, the Flight 93 National Memorial, StoryCorps actually did a big project with the Library of Congress, the Arlington County Public Library, a number of other places like that across the country. And so the first step of this book was to go out and look at those original archives. And those collections total about 5,000 oral histories, of which the researcher who was working with me on this, we collected about 2,000 of those stories that mm-hmm. formed the foundation for this book. And then I did about 200 stories that I collected myself over the course of this project. And then, you know, we sort of boiled that down over, you know, about a year and a half of writing and editing to the 480 voices in here, both stories that I did and then archival oral histories as well.
So the people that you interviewed, I remember hearing somebody that you interviewed or interviewed you, they said, what is your, you know, most telling story or one that stuck out? And I mean, it would be difficult to, I guess, choose one because every person has their own story and their own take on it. But is there one that did maybe brought you in emotionally? Because I know as a journalist, you know, it's your job to, you know, kind of keep that neutral ground. But was there one that really stood out and brought you into that story emotionally?
Yeah. So a theme of stories that sort of most connected with me, the ones that I sort of found most haunting and stuck with me over the course of this book was the way that really luck or fate or whatever you want to call it played such a monumental role in that day, determining who lived and who died, that you saw these incredibly minor events in life, sort of the types of decisions that each of us makes 1,000 times a day that we don't actually think about at all. You know, when to run an errand, whether to stop for coffee on the way into work, what elevator to get on, right, what plane to catch, what train to board. And the way that those types of decisions really impacted that day. Michael LaMonaco, who was the chef at Windows on the World, the restaurant atop the North Tower, he, on a normal day, on all other days, would have been in his kitchen at 8:30 in the morning. But that day, on 9/11, he decided to stop and buy a new pair of glasses at Lens Crafters on his way into work, and ultimately ended up missing the last elevator to the top of the tower.
Wow.
And 72 of his colleagues died, and he didn't. Joseph Lott, who was a computer salesman that day and was supposed to be attending a conference at Windows on the World, he was he was having breakfast at the Marriott Hotel at the base of the towers that was nestled in between the North Tower and the South Tower. And one of his colleagues at breakfast gave him a new tie that she'd been on vacation the week before, saw a tie that she thought he would like, and gifted it to him. And he was so touched by the gesture that he then actually decided to go put it on. And so he went back to his hotel room to change his shirt and put on this new tie. And his colleagues went on to the conference, and he lived, and they didn't. And it was sort of those types of stories, the way that you realize that, you know, these incredibly minor decisions end up unlocking alternate futures or alternate worlds, that I just sort of found so haunting in as I was going through these stories. You know, one of the police officers in the book, you know, he says, you know, it was a day of lefts and rights. And that was so literally true that day, that you see these stories of, you know, at the Pentagon, sort of particularly people who, you know, came out of a destroyed office, and those who turned left died, and those who turned right lived. And just sort of those incredibly haunting stories of sort of what could have been that people never consciously decided one way or another.
We hear a lot about people that were first responders and still dealing with a lot of the after effects, you know, illnesses and diseases from the dust particles or whatever that caused them to be ill. But is there, was there a lot of people that you talked to that was still dealing with PTSD 18 years later? Because, you know, it 18 years is 18 years, but still it's almost like yesterday. Like I said, I can think like it was just yesterday. I couldn't imagine seeing up front and handing, you know, somebody a ticket that, you know, eventually caused this, or, you know, two blocks away that was dealing with, you know, seeing the towers fall or somebody jumping out of a building. So of all the people, who do you feel that, or did they say they were still dealing with the after effects of that?
Yeah. And that's a big theme of a lot of the stories. You know, both survivor's guilt, you know, sort of people right. who did escape the attacks and wondered why they did. You know, PTSD issues for lots of the people involved. And then, of course, the physical health ailments of that day as well. You know, I think one of the things that, again, we forget when we tell the history of 9/11 is that there really is no history of 9/11, that 9/11 is something that we as a nation are still living with, and that many of those people who responded that day are still very much living with. And so, this summer we saw the 200th death of a New York City firefighter from injuries or diseases stemming from 9/11. And so, you know, the department that lost 343 firefighters on 9/11, has now lost almost 2/3 that number in the years since to related injuries and diseases. And that in the Arlington County Fire Department, which was the primary agency that responded to the Pentagon, they talk about they lost about 10% of their department to PTSD in the months and years afterwards, which is a stunning level of pain to see on an ongoing basis, and that this is going to be something that many of these people live with for the rest of their lives. Right. Will Jimeno, one of the police officers in the book that you follow, he was a Port Authority police officer and was actually buried in the collapse of the towers. He and his sergeant, John McLaughlin, were actually the only two people who survived underneath the towers, who were rescued from underneath the towers. And they were rescued that night, the night of 9/11 into the morning of September 12th. And, Will Jimeno is very straightforward about the battle that he has had going forward in his life, both physically and mentally. And, he says the day that I beat PTSD will be the day that you put me in the ground.
Mm. That's pretty powerful. And how did you choose? I mean,
I should add, Will Jimeno is, doing wonderfully. He is, very happy and healthy and has a great life and, does a tremendous amount of good-hearted, inspirational speaking to students in the military and to inmates and addicts about sort of that journey back and sort of, rebuilding his life.
Right.
Even as well as he is doing, he understands that this is a lifelong battle that he'll have.
And how did you come about the people you chose to be in the book? Was it organically or like, so-and-so down the street, or how did you choose the people that you put into the book?
It's a good question. And, part of a project at this size and scale is, I'm sure a different historian or writer sitting down with the same collection of, 2000 oral histories, it could have written an entirely different book, never repeating a single quote that I actually chose and used myself. I was lucky enough to have a researcher who was working with me on this, Jenny Pachuki, who had been an oral historian at the 9/11 Museum for much of the last decade. And so had actually devoted a lot of time to conducting some of these interviews herself over the years with her colleagues and, really knew the story of 9/11 inside and out. And so she was an incredible guide to, some of the people who had the most interesting stories. But beyond that, what I was trying to do at the journalistic, at the historical level, was to capture the full sweep of the day. And so there are not that many people in the book that you follow start to finish the full day. There are probably only 2 or 3 dozen people who follow through the whole book. Most people sort of only come for the brief moment where their drama of that day intersects with the national drama, because I'm trying to tell a very national story at a very human level. So it is in some ways a very impressionistic or pointillist version of the history of 9/11, as you sort of go person to person, handing off this story as it unfolds around the country over the course of that day.
Truth be told, we've had many topics. We've, you know, and we've had controversial, we've had conspiracy, we've had all, and I'm not going to get too into the conspiracy, but of the people that you talked to, were there any that you talked to that saw it differently? Maybe a little conspiracy of something that they saw that they did not, that you did not even want to put in your in the book, that you just didn't feel comfortable with. Because in 18 years, we've heard a whole gamut of different stories. So is there some stories that you didn't put in a book because it was too controversial or even too conspiracy?
Yeah. So the 9/11 Commission, you know, has done a very good job putting together the facts of that day. I mean, right. Their report is sort of as thorough a debunking of most of the conspiracy theories as you will find. So right. I didn't feel a big need to, retrod much of that ground or to sort of get into a lot of that.
Right.
I will say sort of one of the things that I did struggle with in terms of sort of how to incorporate into this book is the story of how people's faith intersected with that day. Mm. For all of the obvious reasons, it was a day where there were a lot of prayers sent, a lot of prayers made, a lot of prayers answered, and a lot of prayers that weren't. And you know, there are a lot of stories from that day, where people's experience really hinges on, miracles and miraculous, escapes or miraculous, survival that they, that they attribute to a higher power. Right. That they attribute to their own faith and their belief in God. And, I think that one of the things that I sort of struggled with in the writing of this book was how do you treat something like faith and the role of something more powerful than we can understand in that day, because it was an important part of the experience, the lived experience, of many of the people that day who felt that there were higher powers guiding them out of the towers, that kept right. them safe amid the chaos. Stories of angels from that day, both literal and figurative, and sort of how do you tell that story in a way that gives agency to the people who, for whom, that is a central tenet of how that day unfolded for them.
So you feel that the people that you interviewed, there was a theme, or was there a theme that you saw of not necessary bitterness, but more of a religion, spiritual connection?
Yes. And part of that also, of course, has to do with the bias of oral history, right?
Right.
Which is, you are, by the very definition of the project, relying on the stories of the people who lived. One of the other challenges I really struggled with in this was how do you tell the stories of the people who died that day?
Right.
Either in their own words, through some contemporaneous recordings that we have of voicemails or, the cockpit voice recorder from United Airlines Flight 93, telephone calls that people placed out of the buildings when they were trapped, or phone calls from the plane, from the hijacked planes that people placed. That was another one of the real challenges, which is, I really wanted to make sure that I told the story of the victims of that day. And yet, at the same time, you know, those people are not available for oral history. And so you're sort of relying on their stories being told by others or by the evidence that they left behind.
Well, I was born December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. And so that was kind of the first big attack from a foreign country on America, at least, you know, in our modern age. But do you feel, as a historian, do you feel that, or how do you feel it's changed America, even the world, but mostly specifically America? Do you feel like it's grown us together, or do you feel like it's actually divided us in some ways too? Because it seems like religion also, even we talked about religion, how everybody was praying, but also how it separated, you know, the Muslims and the Christians. And do you feel like it's helped bring us together or in some ways divided us?
Well, certainly, you know, in the short term, you saw this unbelievable unity across the country,
right,
and really around the world after 9/11. You know, most people don't realize that the only time in its history that NATO has invoked Article 5, which is the sort of mutual defense clause of the treaty, was to come to the aid of the United States in the wake of 9/11.
Right.
And that there was just such unity at home and abroad in the time thereafter. The decisions that our nation made after 9/11, though, I think are sort of very clearly, in many ways, the root causes of the division that we now see in our politics and our international geopolitics. And that I think part of my goal with this book was to really try to capture that emotion that the country experienced on 9/11, the fear, the chaos, the trauma, the confusion. Because when our leaders reacted after 9/11, when our country reacted after 9/11, we were reacting to the emotion as much as we were reacting to the facts of that day. And so as we sort of hand this world off to a new generation of Americans who have no emotional understanding of that day, I think it becomes harder for them to understand the world in which they live, because they look around and they sort of see a country affected and still wrestling with the challenges wrought by 9/11 at a scale much larger than should be accounted for the facts of that day alone. And you know, it's always hard to tell when you are seeing an apocalypse event, you know, like Pearl Harbor or 9/11 slip from memory to history. But this year, the 18th anniversary, I think you can make a good argument that that's beginning to happen.
Right.
That, you know, you have the first college students arriving on campuses across the country born after 9/11. You have the first recruits of the New York City Fire Department applying to join the fire service born after the attacks. And we, for the first time this year, are now deploying American servicemen and women for the first time in American history to fight in a war, in two wars really, that are older than they are. And that's, you know, an incredible moment for us as a country, a milestone for our country as we pass it.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's, I do remember I lived in Kansas City at the time, and where many people, I worked at a doctor's office at the time, and one of the doctors that worked there, he was from Pakistan, and originally, and he would just get bombarded with cars driving by, calling him names, you know, go back to your country. And he was born here. I mean, his family was originally from there, but he was born here. And that's why I said I feel like it did bring us together for a few days. And then when the realization of who did it, why they did it, I felt like that really, you know, kind of separated us. So, but I think this book, though, does bring a lot of us together, because we get to hear from how many people were in the book total?
480. Yeah.
And every single one of those 480, I'm sure, you know, they had their stories, you know, they had to pick the pieces up and live their lives and try to just go on. But, you know, just because you didn't lose somebody that day doesn't mean you weren't affected. And I think this book, and that's maybe my next question, is what did you write this book to accomplish? What did you want it to do?
Yeah, and I think for me, the goal was to capture the way that 9/11 was actually lived, and to make sure that we as a country don't forget what the experience of 9/11 is when we try to tell the history of 9/11. Because if you boil it down to just the facts of the day, just sort of that neat and clean history that I was right. talking about, you really will never understand 9/11.
Right. Yeah, I like I said, I was looking at your stuff earlier, and like I said, it did give me that little anxiety of because every time you think about it, how many people were lost and how it affected us all. But in a lot of the, you know, there was four different locations: Pennsylvania, the two towers, and then of course the Pentagon. And how did you get access to people at the Pentagon? Were some still working there? Did you have to get authorization to get, you know, their accounts, or was there any, you know, pushback of putting this book together, or no?
So the Pentagon, I did rely a lot on the Pentagon Historian's Office and the archival project that they had done, in part because actually the Pentagon has been a real challenge for historians to recreate that story, not because the Pentagon itself is in any way trying to stonewall it, but by the nature of the work at the Pentagon, sort of people rotate in and out. And right. so, you know, if you were trying to tell the story of Shanksville, a lot of the people who were involved in the Shanksville story are still in and around Shanksville. If you are trying to tell the story of the Pentagon now, you know, that those personnel are scattered all over the country, and actually scattered very quickly after 9/11, because, you know, most people stay at the Pentagon for a year or two. It's just been very, very hard for historians to recapture a lot of the story from inside the Pentagon. There have been great works done by people like the Arlington County Public Library to capture the story of Arlington and the first responders who worked at the Pentagon. There's one really good book on the battle to save the Pentagon on 9/11 called Firefight by two journalists that is sort of an invaluable guide to how that day unfolded.
Yeah. What was your recount of your own story? Of where were you at, and what did you witness? Maybe not in New York, but what did you witness when you saw the first tower fall, or the first hit of the tower?
Yeah, I have an incredibly boring 9/11 story, which was that I was having breakfast in college, sitting in my dining hall. When I first learned of the two crashes, and that despite that being a very boring story, it is still very burned into my mind, and the memory is very vivid. And I remember a great deal of detail about that day and how it unfolded. And I think in many ways, part of what makes this day so resonant to so many of us across the country is that many of us had very similar experiences that day watching 9/11 unfold on television. I mean, in many ways, 9/11 was the first global catastrophe that the world has really ever seen, that, you know, we watched so much of that day unfold live on TVs across the country, even if you were really far away physically from New York, the Pentagon, or Shanksville.
Yeah, I like I said, it's a powerful book. I hope everybody will, you know, get out there and pick it up. I'm sure you can pick it up at all the, you know, Amazons and the bookstores, but The Only Plane in the Sky, an Oral History of 9/11. But this is not the only book that Garrett has thrown out there for us to enjoy. I want to touch on this. I hope you don't mind us doing a switch because we only have about 15 minutes left. And I want to talk about the threat matrix, the FBI at war, if you don't mind touching on that a little bit. Could you, I mean, this is a big deal. I mean, I love history. I don't get it in detail like you, but I'm just a big history buff. And when I saw this, I said, we have to talk about it. So talk about the threat matrix and how you put this together and what it's about.
Yeah, so I've covered national security and technology for most of the last dozen years as a journalist. And one of the things that actually, you know, makes this book, Only Plane in the Sky, somewhat inevitable, perhaps, is that 9/11 is a major hinge in almost every story that I've written about over the course of my career. You know, the rise of the FBI's counterterrorism mission, the rise of the Department of Homeland Security, you know, the rise of the surveillance state, you know, everything having to do with Edward Snowden is effectively a story about 9/11. And of course, the rise of Customs and Border Protection and the Border Patrol and the border crisis that the U.S. is in right now, that is a big part of the day-to-day journalism that I do, it is really a 9/11 story at its core as well. And so this Threat Matrix book, which came out in 2010, was in some ways my first foray into this space. And it's sort of, in many ways, all of the story that is not told in The Only Plane in the Sky. So the book, you know, begins before 9/11 with the rise of international terrorism and continues after 9/11. And really is the story of Robert Mueller's time as FBI director. He's sort of the main character in that book. He took over, of course, on September 4th, 2001, 1 week before 9/11, and thought he was showing up to like fix the computer system, which was the FBI's major problem at the time. And of course, a week later ends up, you know, leading the FBI in the wake of 9/11 through this wrenching transformation from a domestic law enforcement agency into an international intelligence agency. And so, you know, that whole story is what I trace in the Threat Matrix, effectively beginning with one of the first violent hijackings that the U.S. ever experienced, the hijacking of Southern Airways Flight 49 in November 1972, and continuing up through the Times Square bombing in 2010.
Yeah, this is one of the subjects that I love to talk about. And doing your research, I mean, because Robert Mueller, of course, in the last few years have gotten, you know, wasn't he kind of pretty much retired, and they kind of brought him back and out of retirement? I'm sure sometimes he probably wished he would have just stayed home. But was there a time that you, when you started doing your research of this book, where you're like, man, there's some crazy stuff going on that we just don't know about? I mean, that you even were, maybe even got nervous about? Because like I said, truth be told, we touch on everything. We've had... We've had Roger Stone on. We've had all kinds of people on, but we like to hear it both sides, and we want to really get the truth out to the people, because people want to be told the truth, and a lot of people don't believe that they're being told the truth. But when you're doing your research, is there anything that you feel that there's some scary stuff out there that we should know but we don't?
Yeah. So I'll answer that question in sort of two parts.
You got it.
The first is, you know, I think when you look at 9/11, part of what was so confusing to us that day was the fact that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden were such a mystery to us as Americans.
Right.
And, you know, I remember that day being so confused about this picture of Osama bin Laden on the TV, where sort of everyone on TV seemed so sure that this was the guy who had attacked us. And I just couldn't understand sort of how or why, because I had never heard of him.
Yeah, same here.
I'd never heard of this Al-Qaeda group. And so, you know, in many ways, 9/11 was sort of America waking up to the fact that it was already in the middle of a movie that it didn't know was playing, that, you know, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had been on the rise for a number of years, and the data points were there. I mean, the bombing of in 1998 of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, the bombing in 2000 of the USS Cole. And yet, you know, until they struck the homeland, we sort of didn't really understand, I think as a country, what a threat Al-Qaeda posed. And so a big part of that threat matrix books ends up being sort of trying to tell that early bit of the story and how, you know, the FBI had responded both before and since. And then to sort of fast forward to the second part of the answer, and sort of be thinking about, you know, what are, you know, what is the story that we are not paying attention to right now as a threat? You know, to me, a lot of my day-to-day journalism and day-to-day work involves cybersecurity now. And, you know, 9/11 at its core was a failure of imagination on behalf of the nation, you know, that we had not imagined the planes ever being used as missiles.
Right.
And so that was a threat that we were very unprepared for. And in the cyberspace, one of the things that we really do see very consistently is those same failures of imagination that, you know, when Iran first struck the United States, they attacked Sheldon Adelson's casino in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which was on nobody's list of one of the most critical targets to defend in the United States. You know, when North Korea first attacked the United States, they came after Seth Rogen's stoner picture, the interview, by attacking Sony Pictures Entertainment, which was, again, not on anyone's radar as a place that we needed to be defending. You know, and we were very unprepared for the idea of having to basically defend free speech against foreign nation states, because that's really what the Sony Pictures Entertainment attack was about, was whether, no matter how bad the movie actually is, and if you talk to government officials, they will say sort of the greatest crime that North Korea committed was forcing the U.S. government to have to sit down and watch Seth Rogen's movie. But if artists inside the United States don't feel like they can freely express themselves because they will be attacked by a foreign nation, you know, that has a pretty chilling effect on free speech. China, when it sort of first attacked us in a surprising way, you know, we had spent so much effort trying to secure Pentagon networks, the intelligence community's networks, and yet, you know, they surprised us by coming in and stealing the U.S. government's personnel records from the Office of Personnel Management, which was something that none of us were paying attention to in terms of the theft of those records. Represents one of the greatest intelligence coups in a half century. You know, it'll be a generation or two before the U.S. is able to sort of fully recover from the theft of those records. And then, of course, in 2016, you saw the attack by Russia. And when, you know, the U.S. talks about critical infrastructure, we talk about electrical grids, we talk about water systems, we talk about hospitals. And the thing that we were totally unprepared for in 2016 was an attack on America's confidence in itself. You know, we were unprepared for an attack on sort of the foundations of our democracy and our trust in one another and as Americans. And that sort of turned out to be sort of the soft underbelly of American democracy in a way that Russia understood, but that we had never understood ourselves. And so when you sort of look at that pattern, it's clear that we can still sort of suffer from those failures of imagination like 9/11. And in some ways, I think the most likely next failure of imagination, which is always something that's hard to predict because by its very nature, you are sort of predicting the thing that you aren't thinking about. But I think we're likely to see over the next couple of years attacks on data assurance and data integrity that will sort of undermine or could undermine, you know, our economy, our bank accounts, stock markets, hospitals, medical data, you know, sort of if so much of our modern world is buried in computer databases,
right,
that we sort of assume that we can trust, that at some point, if we suddenly show, if an adversary is able to show that we can't actually trust that data anymore, that'll be a huge issue for us to work through.
Well, I mean, this is so fascinating. We're almost out of time. We only have a couple minutes left, and down the future we'll have to have you back. But do you feel do you think the biggest threat for America in the future is mostly cyber? And then, because I've always thought about this, it's pretty easy to attack, our grids, our, nuclear power plants. I mean, it's, even though there's facilities that are, are guarded, but, most of us can drive right up to most of these facilities. But do you feel like America since 9/11 is safer, or do you feel like we're still very vulnerable right now?
Well, so both are true, right? Every day, we are both becoming more secure in cyberspace, right, and we are making ourselves more vulnerable.
Right. Right.
And, the challenge is, I think that we are relatively early on in that cycle, and we are probably, 10 to 15 years away from being anywhere close to how secure we ultimately should be. And I think the thing that worries me in the cybersecurity realm is that we have seen over the last decade all of the ways that our information can turn out to be insecure. You know, that as we've digitized all of the information in our lives and gone from analog to digital, just how many ways that can be exploited by bad actors.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, we're about to make, and in the process of making, sort of all of those same mistakes with our infrastructure and our stuff. And that sort of the rise of the Internet of Things, which is, as insecure in many ways as your... as our information has been over the last decade, that's a really huge problem. It's one thing if hackers are able to, lock up your computer with ransomware on your right. desktop at work. It's something else if hackers are able to, turn ransomware onto your refrigerator as we turn all of our appliances in our homes into smart devices. And it's something else entirely if they are able to, manipulate your autonomous vehicle or grandma's pacemaker. it's one thing if you show up at work one day and your computer isn't working. It's something else if you are barreling down the highway at 70 miles an hour and suddenly, a little message pops up on your screen saying, pay $300 in Bitcoin right now to unlock your brakes.
Wow. In fact, I just saw a commercial earlier this morning, which is kind of synchronicity there, about somebody trying to get away from the cops, and the cops say whatever whatever that system
OnStar,
they,
yeah.
yeah, OnStar, turn off this car, and it the car turned off. And that's what I think a lot of people are getting scared of. It's like, yes, I want to be protected, but how much am I giving away? How much freedom am I giving away? And I hear this from politicians and other people, like, well, if you want to be safe, we start that. We heard this right after 9/11. That's why I think a lot of people get into the conspiracy side of it, because it's like, well, I don't know. I don't know about this. So, but I don't want to get too far into that, because I know it gets a little crazy, and we love talking about it. But Garrett, thank you so much. This was so fascinating. Your wealth of knowledge, and thank you for writing the book, The Only Plane in the Sky. You can get that pretty much anywhere, Amazon, I'm sure, pretty much every bookstore. And is there another book coming out soon? I mean, 400 and some. I mean, are you
No,
just
that's
gonna?
it for now.
For
Yeah.
you're like, I'm tired. I'm ready to take a break. But thank you so much. You can go to Garrett's website, Garrett Graff. Is it Graff or Graff?
Graph, yep.
Graff.com. That's two F's, two R's, two T's. And you can check out all his upcoming events, any speaking engagements, and please support him. Thank you guys so much for joining Truth Be Told. We always love having you in the chat room. There's some people in the chat room that are sharing their thoughts and asking questions that I wish I would have been able to get to, but we ran out of time. But until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron. Garrett, take care of yourself.
Thanks.
All right.